at the moon. Don't know or what I am. In your arms a while, face a bit before it knows to smile.
We're here, but there's no trace. Everywhere I turn, you kiss my face. Namaste and blessings. The Swami welcomes you with great love and great respect from the heart of all. This is Meditative Living with Swami Shivananda Giri. Today, we give episode 17. In the Authoritative Guru Gita series. This Guru Gita was translated from the Sanskrit by Acharya Padma Najendra, put together and commented upon by Swami Anantananda Giri, all at the request and under the close supervision of Mahamandaleshwar Swarupananda Vishwaguru Maharaj of Los Angeles, California, who in 2007 became one of Hinduism's 80 Mahamandaleshwars. By definition, a Mahamandaleshwar is a theological authority, the weight of whose stance is second only to the four Shankaracharyas. So truly, this is the authoritative position on the ancient text known as Guru Gita. In Guru Gita, it is a conversation between Shiva and his wife, Parvati. Because she had already come to full realization, and she was guided to that point within herself by Shiva, but it was done very pragmatically, full of love and direct experience. Now, what Shiva is doing prior to the beginning of this text is he is addressing the seven Saptarishis, the very first instructors of Shiva's methods for attaining self-realization. So she's curious because he's going into all kind of stuff in this presentation to these guys that he never said to her, was never part of her practice or any of that. So she asks, what is it you're doing, and how is it that a human may become like you? Well, no one had asked Shiva this question before. So he gives the Guru Gita, which is explaining the purpose, the role, and many other things about the Guru. Please understand, even though for a number of you listening, the word guru may have a negative connotation, which is most unfortunate, but it is part of the way things work. Now, beginning with verse 185, we're going to plow through to the end of 203, just straight, and then there will be some commentary and discussion of what Shiva told Parvati. Shiva says to Parvati, having obtained a glimpse, one should remain alone, free from all attachments and contacts. By his grace, one should remain at peace. Whatever one is given or not given, whether scarcely or in abundance, should always be enjoyed without desire and with a contented mind. The one, the individual, who becomes the all is always peaceful and happy wherever they might be. This state is called the state of the all-knower. Wherever the liberated one stays, that place becomes meritorious. O goddess, I have told you the characteristics of a liberated man or woman. O goddess, this is my advice to those who take the path of the Guru. The Guru is the bestower of liberation. Having accepted this path, devotion to the Guru is very much your duty. I salute the Lord Guru, who is intent on giving shelter to all, who is the author of all the Vedas, and who is the bestower of self-knowledge. Even though one may be well-versed in the Vedas, the Agamas, and other spiritual texts, without a guru, self-knowledge is not attained. One may be immersed in the worship of Shiva or Vishnu, but without the knowing through the living guru principle, all this is merely a waste. Dear one, the worship of Shiva without the knowledge of his true nature is like a picture of a lamp, which has no power to dispel darkness. By the power of the guru's initiation, all one's actions will bear fruit. By obtaining a guru, everything is attained. Without a guru, all one's actions are rooted in childishness. One without a guru is said to be no more than an animal, a worm, or an insect. Shiva's true nature is one's very own self. But one cannot come to know this by oneself. Therefore, one must renounce all worldly contacts by every means possible. Disregarding the conflicting scriptures, one should take shelter in the Guru. Whoever reveals the splendorous secret of the self, dispelling all doubt with one pointedness, I worship that one as Lord Guru. The Guru without self-knowledge, who is a hypocrite and a liar, should be abandoned. Such a person is not at peace himself. How will that one bring peace to others? The stone in the river has no knowledge of helping other stones to cross over. If it cannot even cross over by itself, how can it help others? There are those gurus, the mere sight of whom causes confusion. They are not worthy of respect and should be renounced even from a great distance. One should take shelter only in people of true knowledge. Those ones acting as gurus are imposters, indulging in sinful action, who are atheists, who are slaves to women, who are ungrateful, and who are cheaters. Those who renounce their duties, who endlessly indulge in arguments, who are sensualists, who are unforgiving, angry, and violent, these types of gurus who are devoid of knowledge and who shirk their duty commit a great sin. Dear one, discrimination should be utilized to identify a guru of a very different sort. That guru who does not exhibit the shortcomings explained prior should be sought out and served with single-minded devotion. Now, the commentary. It would be fair to say that my position on the matter of what constitutes a qualified guru is distinctly more subjective than that represented here in verses 198 to 203. Self-realization, that's with the big S, is uninterruptedly knowing everything and everyone as that self. It is the unbroken awareness of only unity. The person who enjoys this state still experiences emotions, including anger. He or she still has a personality and likely has many, if not most, of the habits they had prior to self-realization. It is true that the experience of self-realization tends to make the behavior of the experiencer more sattvic, more pure. On the other hand, once this perspective is reached, it is not annulled by passing emotions, argumentative tendencies, the occasional fit of rage, or by sexual activity. All of these scenarios can be enacted at the personal, individuated level while the individual continues to perceive only unity as the source and the underpinning and the substance of all that can change. Many people cannot accept this simple premise, but it is the truth. For this reason, many gurus have chosen to not even bother trying to convince others of this and have subsequently been branded hypocrites for exercising their freedom in a way that runs contrary to some form of dogma or another. This is why I insist on deconstructing dogma. Dogma is the antithesis of freedom. Any enlightenment that does not come with absolute freedom is completely worthless. This is not to say that a person claiming to be self-realized couldn't be an imposter. The red flags described by Shiva could rightly tip the would-be disciple off to a counterproductive guru-disciple relationship, which would only serve to feed the ego and fatten the wallet of the alleged guru, without necessarily conferring any benefit to the disciple at all. On the other hand, the disciple very well could be benefited even in this scenario. Adida, a guru who I have mentioned and or quoted a handful of times in the course of this commentary, was a very controversial figure. His behavior certainly wasn't orthodox. The debate still rages as to whether he was one of the finest exemplars in all history of crazy wisdom, or rather a lecherous, narcissistic, running a slick con operation. The visionary artist, Alex Gray, once produced a painting of Adida, portraying him as the true guru. Gray drew the public criticism of an acquaintance for portraying Adida in this light and for not acknowledging any of the serious allegations that had been levied against him by former devotees. In response to this criticism, Alex Gray raises some excellent points that are quite relevant to the matter at hand. Alex Gray replied in this way: "Regarding my portrait of Adida, I think all your critique of my willful blindness to the shadow of some spiritual leaders is fair. I made the portrait as a commission for a devotee of Adida. It was not meant as a full summary or critique of the personality of Franklin Jones. I had read Adida's work for many years and respected his teachings, but was never in a devotee relationship with him myself. Years before, my teacher, Namchai Norbu, a Tibetan Buddhist leader, had told me, 'Sometimes it is better to keep the guru at a distance. The closer you get, the more human they appear. If you believe the guru is a Buddha, you receive the spiritual transmission of a Buddha. If you believe the guru is just as human as you, that's the level of transmission you will get. If you believe the guru is a dog, you get the transmission of a dog.' This affected the way I wanted to portray Adida, because I wanted the devotee who commissioned the work to get the maximum empowerment from the transmission of their guru. So I painted the full-on God-man fusion with all the bells and whistles." Now, returning to Swami Anantananda's commentary. Some people did see God in Adida Samraj, and this helped them to then see God in themselves and in everything and everyone else they encountered. We will never know definitively if this was the outlook of that particular guru himself or not. What we do know is that some devotees regarded him as guru and progressed spiritually as a result. On the other hand, there were plenty of people who could not see someone behaving the way that this man did and still regard them as the guru. Alternatively, one might come to the conclusion that a guru like Adida is fully self-realized but find themselves unwilling to be subjected to the treatment that goes along with being the disciple of such a figure. There is nothing wrong with this position either. For example, if the accounts are true, this may have included receiving sexually transmitted diseases from the guru and or being separated from one's spouse and paired with another devotee. I'm not saying this is true or false. I honestly have no idea. But I certainly wouldn't consent to that, nor would I ask anybody else to. It is for this reason that the scripture makes provisions here for the seeker to avoid such a guru and to find one who better suits his or her own sensibilities without incurring any adverse consequences. The distinction I'm making, one that is often lost on people, is that it is a fruitless endeavor to focus on what we perceive as the shortcomings of others. We can dissociate ourselves with others whose behavior toward ourselves or others we simply refuse to accept. However, the trend I notice when this occurs is that people tend to take this as a step further and rattle off lists of reasons that this person isn't enlightened and that person can't be a guru, or even that the entire institution of gurus guiding disciples is somehow flawed. Without exception, this amounts to nothing more than speculation. The inferences that people tend to make in the course of such speculation are almost always based upon very fundamental misconceptions regarding what exactly it is that constitutes enlightenment, and focus on things that are totally irrelevant to enlightenment. So again, the above verses give the seeker the green light to pass on becoming involved with certain types of gurus. This is necessary in the context of the Guru Gita, because it otherwise says, essentially, that it is a sin to be disinclined toward the guru. It is interesting to note that Jesus also seems to have found it necessary to point out that one does not necessarily burn in hell for all of eternity simply for being unable to accept a particular guru. The guru is advocated, but not in a dogmatic way. Jesus said, "Whoever blasphemes against the Father will be forgiven, and whoever blasphemes against the Son will be forgiven. But whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit will not be forgiven, either on earth or in heaven." Until it has been experienced, it is impossible to comprehend God in the transcendent aspect, the Father, as Brahman or as Paramashiva, beyond Shiva. Thus, it is basically a given that the unenlightened aren't going to fully appreciate God in the way that someone with firsthand experience does. It's likely even that he or she will have some not so nice things to say to those who either do have a personal relationship with God or to those who take his existence on faith. Perhaps they take issue with the things other ignorant people have justified doing in the name of God, or perhaps they can't conceive of why things that they view as being wrong with the world could be allowed to be the case if there were a God. Either way, it is by design that people are ignorant in the first place. And these are symptoms of ignorance. For this reason, this particular error does not affect any karma from which a person cannot be redeemed. Sonic, let's go ahead and do the break song, and we will continue with the commentary here in just a little bit on meditative living.
Shiva, 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 Shi
Namaste and blessings. Welcome back to Meditative Living. This is Swami Sivananda Giri. And we are doing episode number 17 in the authoritative Guru Gita series. Continuing the commentary, we just talked about the aspect of the Father as described by Jesus. Now, let us discuss the aspect of the Son. The Son is God in the embodied aspect as the personal guru, as Jesus was to those disciples. It is not unreasonable for the average person who is subject to ignorance and delusion of individuation to be incapable of understanding how an individual could be both fully human and fully divine at the same time. Thus, people generally are disinclined toward the guru and may even expend a lot of energy attempting to vilify all gurus or take individual ones down a peg or two. Well, the karma this engenders is not pleasant, but a person can be redeemed from that as well. As long as one uses this life to serve in some way, whether that is conceived as God the Father or the Son of God, i.e. God as transcendent, or God as personal, the net result in their life will be their spiritual upliftment. In describing these two aspects of the divine, Nisargadatta Maharaj of India once said, "I know that I am nothing. That is wisdom. I know that I am everything. That is love. My life is a movement between these two points." Nisargadatta knew himself to be that which is both God without form, the Father, and God with form, the Son, functioning as a teacher to some. That which moves between these two extremes, which is embodied by the personal guru, is Holy Spirit. To set oneself up in opposition to both the Father and the Son is to oppose Holy Spirit in every way that has been made available to improve oneself during their earthly sojourn. To adopt this stance is to believe in and serve nothing but the deluded ego sense. The net result of this is that any good karma one may have accrued begins to be depleted, while simultaneously only undesirable karma is created. This karma is worked out both on earth and in the afterlife, the subtle realms. Not being forgiven in heaven, the individual, according to the cosmology given by the various dharmic traditions, is instead destined to work out the consequences of their maligned actions in one of the hellish astral realms. The takeaway message here is that the guru whose company the seeker should keep is the one who has a supernatural capacity to bring peace to his or her disciples' minds. This effect is very noticeable in the presence of one's guru. When the effect of a supposed guru upon an individual is confusion, that person should look elsewhere for their guru. However, one should not disparage any guru that they do not accept in that position. The reason for this is twofold. First, the guru is not necessarily a fraud just because someone believes they are. Nobody becomes a guru without people arguing the point. Second, even if one is correct in asserting that the guru himself does not accurately perceive himself as the self of all, if any of his disciples is able to perceive this in spite of the guru's own apparent defect, to interfere with their absorption of the transmission would be a great disservice to that devotee. In this case, one should expect to suffer the karma that that entails. Kindly allow this Swami to expand a bit here. As has been mentioned before, here in the West, there are a great number of people who say the word guru like they're holding a dead rat by the tail. This is most unfortunate. Because, again, allow this Swami to point to the fact that the term guru is the descriptor of a function, not the title of a human. That function is the knowledge that dispels the ignorance, or the light that dispels the darkness. That's all it means. That's it. Any of the personality level flaws, inconsistencies, aberrational behaviors associated with particular humans don't interfere with that function. Not for all, for some most certainly, but not for all. Use the bringing of peace to your mind as the measure of one who might be worthy. That's all. In satsang, in video conferences with this Swami, many, many, many times, after the meditation session, this Swami will say, questions, comments, complaints. And it is very frequent. People can't even reply. They can't say anything. Now, this is not a magic trick. It is not a delusion. It is just they have come to peace for a time. The world will, their minds will, their bodies will overtake this peaceful repose. And they will again be very busy and very distracted and all the rest of that. That's completely natural. That's not a problem. This enlightenment and liberation thing is not hit the drive-through and get a supersize and drive away back into the world. No. It is not just add water and stir. No. It is not drop some DMT or LSD and have some tripped out. No. 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 Nope. All of those things can be attempted. Okay, great. But none of any effect can be sustained. Nope. Doesn't work like that. Not at all. Returning to the text, verse 204, Shiva says to Parvati, "This should not be told to anyone other than the disciple." Now, what he's referring to here is what he had just had to say about real gurus, fake gurus. Okay. Faith, back to the text here. Faith, or bhakti, is indeed the cause of fulfillment for all humans. There are five types of gurus. They are hidden, firm, loving, abiding in silence, and freely wandering. Everything given by the guru is what is best for the disciple, for their fulfillment, and for the destruction of sins and karma. One should accept all this eagerly, but should never cheat the guru materially or of other resources. Oh, good lady, I am satisfied by anything offered to the guru. The disciple should protect the guru's sandals, the mudra, and the guru mantra. The commentary. The admonishment that the disciple should protect the guru's sandals can be taken literally in the event that the disciple has been gifted a pair. It should also be understood figuratively to indicate that disciples should not bring unfit individuals to the feet of the guru as if the guru was a mere curiosity or entertainment. In doing so, the disciple does his part or her part to keep the esoteric secrets intimated by the guru to those sitting at their feet, like the mudras and the mantras. Keep those out of the hands of those who would misuse them or fail to appreciate them. The esoteric power of the mantra has already been discussed. Mudras are hand gestures that possess occult meaning and magical efficacy. The word mudra can also mean a seal, as in a personal seal that someone uses to sign letters or which is used to stamp coins. Another meaning of the word mudra is a mystery. The guru's signature is stamped all over creation. This is the great mystery. Allow this Swami to expand there. You gotta be able to sort out and distinguish when guru is being used in reference to the source of all and everything, and that to which all and everything returns, and when it is being used in reference to the individual who is carrying out the guru function, or the fraudster who's scamming. Okay? You have to be able to sort that stuff out. Returning to the commentary. The guru and what he or she has to offer are precious and should be treated as such. Sometimes we share that which is precious to us with those who we know will appreciate it or at least respect it in the absence of these qualifiers, anything precious should be kept to oneself, especially when that something is the guru. Like, you might talk about the joy you found in the enchanting beauty of some picturesque and timeless landscape you had the good fortune of visiting. So too, is it perfectly natural to describe the joy you have found at the guru's feet. Whether or not it is appreciated is up to the listener, but bragging is not appropriate. Sharing confidential information is not appropriate. Putting powerful techniques into the hands of the uninitiated is not appropriate. Allow this Swami to expand here. Why is it we do not hand loaded weapons to five-year-olds? Is it that the mere placing of that object, the loaded weapon, in the hands of that uneducated, unprepared person could be dangerous to both that person and others? That is the reason. There are a great many in this world at this time who should not have any sort of powerful abilities. And that's entirely appropriate, because there are a great many who would misuse them, bringing damage to others and to themselves. This is why the oral tradition has lived always. It is not about the words in a book. Nope, nope, nope. Those are helpful. Those can be utilized in a good way, in a supportive way, to point people in the direction of that which is directly knowable within themselves. Yes, wonderful, great use. Or you can prop up a table with it, whatever. You see? This Swami is a Swami. Yep, yep, yep. It is this Swami's most joyous and most solemn dharma to assist the one within all in whatever way is most appropriate. Yep. And it's a great gig. And this Swami can attest and testify in the early parts of the performing of such a gig. Yeah, there's a lot of things to trip over. That's part of it too. It's not really a problem. And every problem encountered has a solution. Not a problem. We are best served when we have contentment. As boring as that sounds, that is the best position we can hope to maintain within this world and on this planet, which is in the Kali Yuga, which is the darkest of time. It's okay. That's how it's supposed to work. Just understand, please. all this stuff to get worked up about is part of the puppet show. It's not you. Anything that gets you all worked up and unable to withdraw from or to see in its appropriate context is temporary and only recognized and observable from the point of the limited individual. All that is wonderful is eternal and completely unlimited, and there to be enjoyed. That is the nature of the big S self. Love it, ignore it, hate it, doesn't matter. The self is just fine. Only you, in your limited, individuated perspective, can even experience such feelings. Now, as we discussed in the commentary, it is entirely possible and appropriate that even one who has been tasked with the function of guruing may display anger, may have sex, all sorts of human things, because they still are human. This part doesn't really get into the books all that often. Because, you know, generally the purpose of an author putting something in a book is to sell copies. And even the author's perspective may change over time. Either more deeply into the perspective that was printed at that time, or it might change into something completely disregarding that point of view printed at that time. Ask anybody. Whatever they printed, whatever they wrote, was what they understood and the way they saw things at the time they did it. It is not the same forevermore. Not how it works. So, kindly accept this Swami's thank you for allowing this Swami to be part of your experience. It's a wonderful thing to watch. We'll be back next week with Meditative Living, episode number 18 of the Authoritative Guru Gita. Thank you ever so much, Sonic Aitchison, sitting over there in Brighton, England, making all the things happen that should and keeping all the things from happening which shouldn't. Only by Sonic's efforts is this Swami capable of presenting this program. So thank you ever so much. Namaste and blessings. Om Namo Narayanam.